All right. Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Workforce Labor Economic Development Finance Policy Committee today for March 25th, 2026. We've got roll call votes on each one of these, so we want to see how they turn out, and we've got a lot of testifiers. So I want to thank everybody for willing to come in and testify to this. We're going to have first up is House File 4110 with Representative Zalesnikar. I'd also like to invite now up the Department of Labor and then also Mr. Bence, I guess, from ARM. If you guys could come forward, please. I'm going to try to keep the on deck folks at the table if we can. We are going to do certainly the bill overview from our author to the bill, and then we're going to move over to testifiers, and everybody today will have about 2 minutes, pretty of a hard stop at 2 minutes, to make sure that we get out of here on time today. So with that, first our action would be our minutes to approve. Mr. Chair, thanks for excusing me yesterday. I was under the weather, but I feel much better today, so thank you for that. Would you please maybe make a motion to approve the minutes?
Glad to, Chair Baker. So moved.
All right. Any member questions on that? All those in favor signify by saying aye of approving the minutes.
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are passed. First up, again, Representative Zalesnikar, to your bill, House File 4110.
Thank you,
please,
Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Baker and members. This bill, House File 4110, is really a common sense bill. Imagine your mother's in assisted living. Imagine you have a fire. Imagine you call 911. Imagine you have a disabled child living in a group home. There are situations that have been going on before this bill that requires staffing for vulnerable adults and response. That's all this bill is. It's been happening. People know the patient comes first. The community comes first when you're in emergencies. All this bill does, it's a common sense bill, but it gives clarity, because without clarity, bad things will happen. And so what this bill does is, when the employee is the only person working at the time and location and providing a service that can sustain life, and when they're working with vulnerable adults, and when, if there's an emergency response, it does not take away anything for restroom breaks or meals and having that. All it does is say that standard break times that would be common in other work settings don't apply all in the settings when you have emergencies and when you have vulnerable adults. In group homes, it's very common to have one person for 24 hours a day. We are not in a position, members, to be changing that whole model. And if you think about, if there's not clarity, you could have somebody go into their car to smoke a cigarette and leave the house. You could have them go eat their meal in the car. What has been standard is it's community-based living. We've went to a home-based model. We want it to feel home-like, so employees eat with seniors, with tenants, with residents, with patients, and they have flexibility. Everybody in healthcare that I know, when I've talked to, says this is, it's ridiculous to not have common sense. We're caring for people 24 hours a day in an emergency vulnerable adult way. It's insulting to me, having worked in healthcare for 40 years. We did this all the time. I had great teams with the union. I had great teams that non-union employees. Everybody had the same common good. Make sure you protect the patient. Make sure you take care of the resident. And in the off times, everybody after a meal, everybody wants to go to the restroom. And if the fire alarm's going off, you change gears. You reprioritize and re-triage care if the ambulance is coming or there's an emergency or somebody falls. But everybody knows that's working shift work and works in healthcare. And then they take their break later. So if they were planning to go eat at that time, doesn't mean they don't eat. They just don't leave a resident laying on the floor bleeding, or they don't go outside if they're the only one in the facility. So it's really a common sense bill, Chair Baker and members.
And thank you for that, Representative. Again, just to make sure we have this, Representative Zalesnikar moves House File 4110, and we'll have it referred to the general register. So I just wanted to make sure we got that on the record, too. So I forgot to do that. Thank you very much for that. Mr. Moore, if you could introduce yourself and proceed, and then Mr. Bence is on deck. When Mr. Moore is done, again, we're not going to take any member questions at this point. We'll have somebody else come up, and Nicole Mattson will be on deck after that. So please proceed, Mr. Moore, with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Josiah Moore. I'm the Legislative Director at the Department of Labor and Industry. I'm testifying today in opposition to House File 4110, a bill that would exempt employees in certain situations, largely healthcare employees, from rights to take rest and meal breaks. The governor's budget in 2025 included a provision to strengthen break laws, which went into effect January 1 of 2026. This change replaced the prior break law, the prior rest break law, which guaranteed an employee adequate time to use the restroom within each 4 consecutive hours worked, with a new requirement that an employer allow paid rest breaks of at least 15 minutes within each 4 consecutive hours worked. The department continues to support access to this rest break for all employees. This change in the governor's budget also updated the meal break provision in state law from a requirement for employers to permit employees sufficient time to eat a meal when working 8 or more consecutive hours to the current requirement that employers allow employees at least 30 minutes to eat a meal when working 6 or more consecutive hours. And the department continues to support access to this meal break for all employees. Finally, the updates in the law also included a provision that if an employer does not allow rest and meal breaks as required, they're liable to the employee for the rest and meal break time that should have been provided, plus an additional amount as liquidated damages. The department maintains that these remedies are reasonable. These remedies go to the employee, not to the state, and they are an appropriate measured remedy for situations where an employee is not allowed a break. The bill before the committee today would eliminate access to these rest breaks, meal breaks, and remedies for employees in a variety of situations. While the bill does include language clarifying employees exempt from break protection still must be allowed to eat a meal and use the restroom, it does not provide specific remedies allowing employees to seek redress if these more limited rights it provides are violated. And then both the rest and meal break requirements require employers to allow employees rest and meal breaks. So I wanted to clarify that this leaves employees the option of waiving a break if they choose to do so and if their employer allows them to waive a break. The department has also published guidance that if an employee does waive their breaks, it's a best practice to confirm that in writing with the employee. And then finally, in closing, I want to note that the department has heard from employer and employee organizations on this bill. We appreciate the conversations we've had with them, and we'll continue to engage with those stakeholders and provide technical support as requested. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Next up would be Mr. Bence. Please introduce yourself and continue. And if Nicole could come up to the testifying table, I'd appreciate that. Thank you. Mr. Bence.
Thank you, and good morning, Chair Baker, Chair Pinto, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ken Bence. I'm the Director of Research Analysis and Policy at ARM. ARM is an association whose members provide 245D licensed residential services to individuals on the 4 disability waivers. And a thank you to all of you who saw people from your districts who were here yesterday for Disability Services Day at the Capitol. We appreciate you making the time to do that. I'm here today to speak in support of House File 4110, which would allow for an exemption from the new meal and rest break requirements for employees who are working alone and supporting vulnerable adults. The individuals that our members support in community residential settings and other types of residential settings require a 24-hour plan of care, with many requiring 24-hour direct supervision. The staffing model for most group homes is one staff member supporting anywhere from 1 to 4 residents over an 8-hour shift. The meal and rest break standards that were passed in the last session in 177.253 and .254 require a 15-minute break for every 4 hours worked and a 30-minute unpaid break for every 6 hours worked, and could jeopardize the safety and well-being of the individuals our members support, and are inconsistent with state requirements to provide 24-hour support when needed. Here are a couple of examples from our members of when the break requirements would be challenging to meet. In a community residential home where one staff will be present to provide support and services to anywhere from 1 to 4 individuals, or when staff regularly provide 1-to-1 support for individuals outside their home, such as accompanying individuals to things such as medical appointments, on vacation, other activities or events where the person cannot be left alone, and so that staff can't take a break. Another example is during the overnight hours. Homes will usually have one staff person who may be either asleep or awake, depending on the needs of the individuals in the home. Staff are expected to be able to respond to emergency situations and that may occur and cannot be relieved of duties for a 30-minute break each night. It's important to highlight that while staff are expected to be able to respond to emergency situations during an entire shift, there are still opportunities for downtime, restroom breaks, and time to eat. Often, staff cook meals with the individuals they support and share them together, and they are paid for the entire length of their shift, including restroom and meal times.
Mr. Vance, I need you to wrap it up.
One more second. The goal of 4110 that you are considering is to narrowly tailor an exemption that for these types of residential settings to recognize the unique and critical work that they provide and to ensure that the health and safety needs of the individuals are met at all times.
Thank you. For your time I today. Appreciate your testimony. Again, I apologize for the brevity of this. So, Ms. Mattson, welcome to the table. If you could proceed, and I'm also going to call up Ms. Bakken to the table as well, if you would come forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nicole Mattson, here today with the Long-Term Care Imperative. I can say that prior to my current role, I was a long-term care administrator, much like Representative Zalesnikar, for over 30 years, and I can attest firsthand that caregivers take their responsibility very seriously. When someone is entrusted with the care of vulnerable adults, situations arise when staff step in to ensure that residents are safe, even if that means delaying or shortening a break in that moment. Caregiving does not always happen on a predictable schedule. Residents' needs do not pause simply because the clock says that it's time for a break. Another reality in long-term care is that staff are responsible for ensuring continuity of care at all times. Regulations require providers to maintain appropriate supervision and respond immediately when residents need assistance. In practice, that means staff must be able to prioritize a resident who needs help right away, whether it is assisting with mobility or responding to a request or a concern. House File 4110 provides limited and practical flexibility so that providers are not penalized in situations where staff must respond to the needs of the residents in their care, particularly when there may be only one staff person present or when immediate care cannot be delayed. We really appreciate the bill's recognition of our operational realities in care settings and its effort to balance employee protections with the responsibility of ensuring vulnerable adults remain safe. And I will turn it over to my partner, Shelley Bakken.
Thank you, Ms. Mattson. Go ahead. Please introduce yourself and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and thank you, Representative Zalesnikar, for bringing this bill forward. My name is Shelley Bakken, and I am here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. This bill recognizes an important reality in long-term care and other healthcare settings. Our providers operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, caring for vulnerable adults who rely on us for their safety and well-being. The logistics of staffing and scheduling in these environments can be complicated by circumstances outside of anyone's control, weather events, staff illness, last-minute call-ins, and other unexpected disruptions. Even the best planning and schedule creation can't always predict when a resident's unexpected needs come up. We heard from small providers, for example, that when only a limited number of staff are on duty, managing resident transfers or assisting residents with immediate unexpected needs can make an uninterrupted break time challenging. This bill provides important flexibility in these situations. Providers do prioritize breaks for our employees, not just because the law requires it, but because it is the right thing to do. Breaks allow staff time to rest and reset during demanding work. But despite the best planning and best intentions, there are times when the immediate needs of a resident must come first. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the testimony. Seeing no other testimony for this bill, member questions. Anyone? Pete Johnson, Representative Pete Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Thank you, Representative Zalesnikar, for bringing this bill forward. I do have a lot of concerns with it as far as the broadness of it and who it impacts and who determines things like the location, right? Is that a unit, a floor, an entire facility? Could this be unintentionally applied to hospital settings? Could this be something that when we talk about emergency response, is that in these facilities or this goes out to fire departments, EMS, all of those types of things? And you talked about something being insulting to you that somebody wouldn't care for somebody. In the course of my career, I have left a number of meals sitting on the table as we've gotten dispatched out for calls. Nobody is not going to respond to that, and we heard that here today, that people, whether they are PCAs, whether they are first responders, always respond to that call. It seems as though this hasn't been an issue where people have been left in the lurch, where people that were supposed to be getting care for were left. We didn't hear any examples of that. We did hear some hypotheticals of this could happen or this might happen. And to Representative Schultz yesterday when we talked about hypotheticals and looking for examples before we make these differences, before you get too excited, you're worried about that under the surveillance pricing, a system that's designed to lower wages and drive up prices. This is taking away rights from workers who have dedicated their lives to serving and protecting these people. This bill takes away incentives for employers to provide these breaks, to provide adequate staffing, and then removes the financial remedy for workers that did miss those breaks. I don't necessarily have a ton of questions. If this is an actual problem where people are being left and not being taken care of because people are on breaks, I think we have a broader discussion to have about staffing and narrowing something like this. And in the realm of the workforce committee, we have spent money on training and getting people into these professions. There's a reason that they don't stay. It's because they feel like they're not being treated well. I mean, the number of folks that you see come into these, you hear about the turnover and things like that. To the point of having Disability Services Day yesterday, the folks that I met with cared very, very deeply for the people that they serve. And I don't think they would ever leave them in an emergency situation or in a lurch or something like that. I don't support this. It just feels like it's a shifting of a very small worker right back to be control of the employer and just erodes that. So I guess more just my comments and not necessarily questions. So thank you.
Thank you. Chair Pinto, and then I think we'll bring it to Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe if I could have Mr. Moore come back up, I just had a question about how the law currently works in this area. If we can do that very quickly, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'll dive in, Mr. Chair, if I may. So, Mr. Moore, just how the law works currently as I look at it, if an employer is unable to provide the break that's currently required in the law, then the employer simply is required to pay double the employee's wages at that point. The employee then can be denied the break, but then there simply is essentially a somewhat higher cost. Is that the way the law currently works?
Mr. Moore. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto, for the question. Yes, in the law, the remedies section stipulates that the remedy is to pay the break time that should have been allowed plus an additional amount as liquidated damages, which is essentially what you described.
Okay.
And I do have my colleague, Jessica Gross, here. We need additional detail on remedies.
Okay.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. No, I think that's sufficient. And then, so Representative Zalesnikar, your bill would only apply during an emergency. I'm assuming that you feel like at that point, that's a really important situation, a sort of invaluable situation. We want to make sure that the employee is available, the worker's available to the person they're caring for. And this is written very broadly, so it's not just care workers. But I guess I'm wondering, like, if it's such an emergency, isn't it at that point just worth it to say, boy, it's such an emergency, and at that point we maybe need to pay a somewhat higher cost because we're now denying somebody a break that, you know, we'd want to make sure that all of us have during those multiple hours. So why is that not an adequate remedy right now under the law?
Representative Zalesnikar.
Chair Baker and Representative Co-Chair Pinto, I think there's some confusion because this bill is really clear. It says if you're the sole worker. Mm-hmm. So to the example that Representative Johnson said, that wouldn't apply in those settings. You would never be the sole worker in a hospital floor. You would never be a sole worker in a large nursing home. This is a sole worker in a group home. This is a sole worker. It's very clear. Sole worker. That is as defined and as narrow as you can be. And as far as remedies, to your point, these people are paid the entire 8 hours. There is no lost money. They're not working an 8.5-hour shift and punching out for a half-hour break time that is common in other settings. They are being paid the entire 8 hours. So there is no lost time. So I'm not even sure how the Department of Labor and Industry is going to deal with that remedy because I don't see a remedy. They're being paid. It is flexibility. As far as workforce employers being flexible, they are flexible. When you're awake at night, I've been that employee. I got to do my homework, and I allowed other people to do it. I let them use their phones to, you know, research things, call their families through the shift. They had flexibility, and they liked that. And when they're shopping with another resident, a tenant that needs to go to Walmart, they were getting their own groceries so they don't have to run back at night. They didn't want to work an 8.5-hour shift. They wanted to get home to their families, so they were paid the entire 8 hours. There was no lost pay.
And I'll close with a comment, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I know we want to be moving. So Representative Lesnikar, I think most of us would agree with the principle that's currently in the law. You know, if you're working for 4 hours in a row, it makes sense that you would get a 15-minute break in the 4 hours. That's how the law works currently. If you're the only person working with a vulnerable adult and there's an emergency going on, I totally understand that it may be that that break can't be taken. I do think that then the remedy that's in the law, that for that 15 minutes, you get a little bit of extra pay to recognize that you didn't get that break. And if it's such an emergency as it is in the law, then it makes sense that you would, you know, then there should be a little of extra pay at that point because you're being denied that break. So it's not that you can't take that break. The law is set up that then there's a bit of extra pay. I want to point out the opposition letters, including one from paramedics and EMTs talking about significant concerns about the unintended consequences for EMS systems, other things. For a variety of reasons, the breadth of the law, the ambiguity, and just the fact, as I described, this working, I think it's logical the way it's set up right now. I'll respectfully oppose the bill. Mr. Chair, I think you were going to have a roll call on this bill, I believe.
Go ahead. Yep. Yes, for roll call, Chair Pinto.
It sounded like you were maybe going to. I just wanted to.
Are you finished?
I am. I'm all done. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Representative
Mecklen. Chair Baker, I would like to ask for a roll call.
Okay. Roll call has been called. Closing comments. Thank you for bringing this bipartisan bill to us. This is an important thing. I think we should have caught this last year when the bill went through our system. And I want you to close it up, and then we'll call the roll.
Thank you, Chair Baker and members. This is a perfect example of a disconnect between reality and policy. I've worked in these settings for 40 years, as many people in this room have. This body also sets the funding, and this body also sets the requirements that the resident needs should be met at all times. So there's conflicting policy members that this body has responsibility for. So when you make conflicting statutes, there will be repercussions. And all this bill is saying is having common sense. It doesn't deny anybody from a meal break. It doesn't, and I would never encourage that, nor did I for 40 years. It was having the flexibility to make sure that in healthcare we're putting the vulnerable adults first when you are the only person there. And this is the most common sense bill. And members, I would urge you to vote yes, and we can continue discussions, but there will be consequences if we're not making sure that we're providing care for vulnerable adults, for disabilities, seniors, and young children. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative, for this. As I want to renew the motion that is on the floor here, House File 4110, to be passed and placed under the general register. Mm-hmm. A roll call has been called. The chair votes aye.
Chair Pinto.
No.
Vice Chair Mecklen.
Yay.
Vice Chair Greenman.
No.
Representative Bakeberg.
Yes.
Representative Berg.
No.
Representative Frazier.
No.
Representative Hussein. Representative Johnson Pete.
No.
Representative Johnson Wayne.
Aye.
Representative Kozlowski.
No.
Representative Mueller.
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Schultz.
Yes.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Zalesnikar, aye.
All right. Having seven ayes and six nays, the motion does not carry. Today, the bill will be laid on the table for further consideration. So thank you. Next up is House File 2113. Chair Robbins, if you'd come forward, please. Again, members, we've got a lot of testifiers to this. Mr. Bashi, if you want to come up, please, to the table, and also Ms. Dreyer to the table alongside of Chair Robbins. That would be great. Again, this is an important bill. This is highlighting some small business issues that we have. We're finally able to kind of really dive into this a little bit today. Chair Robbins, welcome to the Committee of Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development. And you have House File 2113. The Chair will move the House File 2113 for consideration. And to your bill, Chair Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate it. I also have an A1. Should we move that first? Or
it's an A2, I think. I think it's an A2 amendment, Chair Robbins. I think that we'd like to just get the bill in the shape you'd like to have it with that. Is there any questions from members about the A2 amendment? And then maybe you want to explain the amendment for us real quick, and then we'll move on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, members, this is a bill that will give a small exemption to our small businesses who are struggling with the Paid Family Leave Act. And the original bill would have carved out an exemption for small businesses with 50 employees or less, which is the standard for federal paid family medical leave. And in consultation with other members on the committee, we decided that was probably a bridge too far. And so in the A2, it limits it to small businesses with 15 employees or less. So that's the change in the A2.
What's that?
Oh, and it also allows the A2, sorry, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
The A2 also allows employers to still participate. So there's an opt-in provision in the A2.
It allows the employees to opt in so that, again, if an employee doesn't want to be out of it, they can still do it at their cost.
Employees
can
still do it.
Members, any questions to the A2 as presented to get the bill in the shape? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? A2 is amended, and to your bill as amended, Chair Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So this has been an ongoing conversation since the Paid Family and Medical Leave Act passed. As you know, this has always been something that small businesses have prioritized. They work with their employees regularly to manage workflow at small businesses and farms. That's just been the way small businesses have operated forever. And this bill, with a one-size-fits-all mandate that applies to every sector of the economy, every single business down to one employee, has created hardships for them to manage their workflow flexibly. And that, members, has been recognized in most of the other states that have paid family medical leave bills. So there are 13 states that currently provide for paid family medical leave at the state level. And of those, many others have this small business exception. Delaware has an exemption, Oregon, Washington, Colorado, Rhode Island, and Maine all have small business exemptions, just like I'm proposing. And some with higher limits, some with lower limits. So I think 15 is sort of in the middle of the pack, and I think it's something that would give relief to our smallest of the small businesses and show them that we are trying to provide the flexibility they need. And, Mr. Chair, one final point. My understanding from Deed is that 67% of the paid family medical leave applications that have been applied for and approved so far this year have been by employees at businesses that have 200 employees or more. So 43,000 applications. So basically, small businesses, because of a study Deed has, show that small businesses don't use paid family leave at the same rate. Their employees don't use it at the same rate, even though they're paying in, while the large businesses have been using it at the highest rate. So I just wanted to point that out, that this is disproportionately already falling on our small businesses, And providing a little exemption for 15 employees or less, I think, is the right thing to do. Thank you, members.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I appreciate you bringing this to a number that is something that we can honestly talk about here. So that's great. Certainly like to have it more. Mr. Beshe, welcome to the committee. Again, we've got a two-minute hard stop here, so we'll keep an eye on things. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Baker, Chair Pinto, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Beshe. I'm the State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business in Minnesota. NFIB supports House File 2113, which would provide an exemption from the PFML mandate to some of Minnesota's smallest businesses. Our members continue to oppose the underlying mandate, and we support meaningful ways to reform it to provide relief to as many small businesses as possible. As we've interacted with our members since PFML went into effect, we have heard consistently about the burden that this program is placing on small businesses. For those who have already experienced a PFML claim, the biggest burden that is cited is the negative impact on staffing and operational disruptions. When a small business experiences a PFML claim, it is proportionately more disruptive and more difficult to absorb. The smaller the business, the higher the hit to their operational capacity. Our members have reported disruptions to workflows, increased strain on remaining employees, and a reduced ability to serve customers who rely on their goods or services. This is particularly acute in industries that depend on consistent production schedules and skilled labor. Many of these employers were already struggling to find skilled employees to begin with, and the need to find, hire, and train a replacement for the duration of an employee's leave is simply not feasible. These same employers will soon be making their first tax payments to the program on April 30th. While these deductions have been running since January, the cash flow impact of this lump sum payment will add to the cost pressures for these small businesses. We've also heard about time and money spent coming into compliance. Please remember that small businesses don't have their own dedicated HR legal departments, so they were required to navigate this largely on their own. Notably, 30% of our members who were surveyed stated that they needed to hire a third-party firm to assist with compliance, which was an additional cost that needed to be absorbed right out of the gate. And for many of our members, this is an ongoing cost. Finally, we've also heard about modifications that our members have had to make to help weather the impact of this mandate. For example, when asked about how PFML has impacted their business operations or decisions, members have cited delaying or freezing hiring, increasing prices, modifying other employee benefit pay raises, and delaying capital investment.
Thank you, Mr. Beshe. Can you wrap up?
Thank you again. We respectfully ask the committee to support House File 2113.
Thank you so much. Welcome, Ms. Dreyer, to the table. Please introduce yourself and continue. And if Ms. Richards could come up to the table, I appreciate that. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Baker, members of the committee. My name is Michelle Dreyer. I am the Director of Membership and Government Affairs for the Electrical Association. The Electrical Association is a trade organization of over 250 electrical contractors located throughout the state of Minnesota. Over 90% of our members have under 50 employees. We provide support to these small businesses by offering education, effective advocacy, business supports, and a supportive community. Electrical contractors are uniquely positioned among the licensed trades to be harmfully affected by regulations under the Paid Family Medical Leave Act and licensing requirements. Apprentices must be supervised by licensed electricians of the same W-2 employer. We're limited to two apprentices or any licensed electrician. This means when a licensed electrician goes out on leave, on medical leave, the apprentices may need to be laid off until the licensed electrician returns. Forced layoffs put a contractor's training investment at risk, render individuals learning the trade jobless, and potentially leave a contractor at 50% staff. Projects are delayed, late penalties may be assessed, and customers are unhappy. 75% of our members have 7 electricians or less, so this is the norm, not an outlier. I thank Representative Robbins and the rest of the co-authors for this bill. It will provide my member contractors some relief for the disruption paid family medical leave has caused to the electrical workforce. While our bill allowing for supervision modifications has stalled, this will provide the relief the electrical industry needs. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Dreyer. Appreciate your time. And next up would be Ms. Richards. And then on deck would be Sarah Pippenberg, if you'd come forward as well, Sarah. So, Ms. Richards, if you could introduce yourself and please continue.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Lauren Richards, and along with my co-owner, Caitlin O'Neill, I am the owner of Tropes and Trifles, an independent bookstore in South Minneapolis. We currently employ 5 staff, 3 part-time and 2 full-time. We strongly oppose any changes to the Minnesota paid leave program that would create carve-outs for businesses of our size. As a small business, we cannot afford to offer paid leave on our own, but we know our employees need to be able to take time off for medical or family leave. This year, our store was in the center of Operation Metro Surge. Our staff witnessed and experienced countless acts of violence against themselves and members of our community. Some of our staff have used all their sick and safe leave time to recover from the mental health impact, as well as the physical effects of being exposed to chemical irritants, including pepper spray and tear gas, sometimes blocks from our store. Because of the ongoing effects of this violence, they need the option to take longer-term leave to recover from the health impacts on themselves and their families. I also know how important paid leave is on the employee side. My mother died from breast cancer in 2023, and I used the maximum paid leave time offered through my small business employer at that time. Prior to her death, my dad, my sister, and I alternated taking time off work to take her to medical appointments, stay with her in the hospital, and provide in-home hospice care. After she died, I took additional time to help with logistics and to grieve. While I do not wish for anyone to experience the pain of caring for a loved one dying from cancer, I want anyone in a similar situation to have the option to provide that end-of-life care without the additional fear and worry of their employment and financial situation being in jeopardy. I urge all committee members to oppose HF 2113 and allow small businesses such as mine to continue to use the invaluable resource of paid family and medical leave. We need our employees to take care of themselves and their families because at the end of the day, they are the most valuable resource that our business has.
Thank you, Ms. Richards, very much. I just want to be clear that, again, nobody would be forced out of the bill. You would have that volunteer choice. So I just want to make sure that it was clear. Thank you so much for your testimony. And, folks, Ms. Pippenberg is actually on Zoom with us this morning, so she's going to join us now. And then Amity Foster would come forward, please, and grab a chair. So, Ms. Pippenberg, if you can hear us okay, would you please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony? If you're speaking, we cannot hear you.
Sorry about that. I was
there
on mute, and I couldn't figure out how to get off. Mr. Chair and Committee, I'm Sarah Pippenberg, owner of Vinaigrette in South Minneapolis. I spent 10 years testifying in support of paid leave and was thrilled when it passed. I supported the state-administered universal program and continue to do so now, precisely because it's good for business, especially small businesses. It provides affordable coverage that I have budgeted for and that I and my employees can rely on. Exempting small businesses with 15 or fewer employees would mean approximately 450,000 Minnesotans, nearly 20% of the workforce, could lose access to paid leave, which would also undermine the program by severely shrinking the pool, increasing costs for everyone else, and when families have to take leave without pay, sales at businesses like mine suffer. Furthermore, benefits start and stop based on employer filings and calendar quarter timing. Small businesses whose headcount fluctuates around the 15-employee threshold would be in peril of suddenly unexpectedly losing coverage for at least the next quarter or suddenly incurring these premiums. Workers in small businesses may plan a birth, surgery, or caregiving around expected coverage. Because the paid leave program provides salary replacement to the employee, businesses can use the employer's salary to cover costs of backfilling the position or paying overtime while they are on leave. And the state has grants to further help the smallest businesses with these costs. If small businesses and their employees lose the critical income while an employee is on leave for a major life event, small business owners will be forced to choose whether to continue to pay their employees their salary, like I did when my employee Linda got ALS, even though I had to work a second job to do so, or I guess they leave them high and dry. House File 2113's small employer opt-in is bad for employees and bad for business. Please vote no.
Thank you, Ms. Pippenberg, for your testimony today. Next up is Amity Foster, and if Kirk Martinson could come up as well to the next table. Ms. Foster, if you please introduce yourself and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Amity Foster. I live in HD 60A, and I want to share my experience with paid family medical leave and why I believe it should apply to everyone, regardless of employee size. I never thought I would use PFML. I have PTO and sick time through my employer, but I was recently diagnosed with breast cancer and have been going through treatment for it. It's not as clear-cut as I thought it would be, and I'm going through time faster than I thought I would. Friends said, take PFML, and I'm in the application process now. I can physically work right now, but I'm a lot more tired, and the mental and emotional drain of not knowing what needs to happen, another surgery, radiation, is affecting how I am able to work. My employer is great, but that should not matter. Not having a clear treatment plan could take all of my sick time or more than I thought. PFML protects me, and it protects my employer. I can take time to heal and be able to do my job at 100% when they come back. Limiting PFML to larger employers means that people will be working at half capacity or less while they could be recovering, bonding with their kids, or taking care of their family. It's not like the need for leave only applies to people who work somewhere with more than 15 employees. Providing infrastructure like PFML allows good employers to actually be good employers. Employees should not have to and sometimes cannot rely on the good faith of their employers. We all need it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Foster. Appreciate your time very much. Kirk Martinson, welcome to the table. If you'd introduce yourself, and if Ellery Roski could come forward to the table, that would be terrific. So go ahead, Kirk, with your testimony. Introduce yourself.
Good morning, Chair Baker and members of the committee. My name is Kirk Martinson. I'm here to testify against HF2113 because none of us can predict the future, and nearly all of us will have a need for paid leave in our lifetimes. I knew parenthood would be an adventure, yet I never could have predicted that when my oldest child was only 2 weeks old, we'd end up in the hospital. Our very loving 100-pound Malamute picked him up gently around his stomach and carried him in her mouth through the dog door and outside. Nobody told us in our parenting classes to watch out for family dogs who want to protect the baby. She had heard the same little cry of him waking up that we did. When we didn't hear another cry, we assumed he'd gone back to sleep until my wife came back into the room and couldn't find him. We're incredibly grateful that we had both been trained lifeguards and knew CPR because we needed it. At the time, I was a graduate student and my wife ran her own business. Neither of us had parental leave. My wife juggled projects while a newborn was sleeping, and I continued to teach classes. When we suddenly found ourselves in the hospital, that became impossible. Yet we had to make it possible in order to pay the bills. 26 years later, he's a mostly healthy young adult. I'm an instructional technologist at a college, and my wife still runs her own business. We're very happy when paid leave became a reality, even though, as her voluntary CFO, it means a little more effort for me. She hasn't carried a leave policy in her 25-plus years of doing business because it hasn't been financially feasible. Minnesota's program is a very low-cost investment in a program with great benefits, unlike what is available on the open market. This bill could remove, as we've heard, over 20% of workers from the program. This is basic math and insurance 101. The smaller the number of people in the pool, the higher the costs for each person. It is the same basic premise that calls us to provide for services like firefighters and police officers in our communities. If each of us contracted individually for these services, only the wealthiest among us could afford them. We all deserve time to care for ourselves and for each other. It's made possible when we do so as a collective community. I urge you to vote against this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony today, Mr. Martinson. Next up is Ellery Roski, and then on deck is Alexandra Fitzsimmons. So go ahead and proceed. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Baker and members of the committee. My name is Ellery Roski, and I'm a working mom of three. My oldest is in kindergarten with after-school care. My middle is in center care a few days a week. And then I'm currently at home with my youngest two-month-old here with me today due to this Paid Family and Medical Leave Act. I work for a small consulting company. There are currently 9 of us employees. And our company had a small parental leave policy that we paid out of pocket prior to being part of this program because it was the right thing to do. We paid employees paychecks for 6 weeks at 60% of their salary. As a small business, this was the best we could do. Thanks to Minnesota, being able to offer an additional 6 weeks is a huge benefit to an employee like me. Additionally, the percentage that our company pays into the program is a small fraction of what we would have paid out of pocket. This year, the company will pay about $300 in premiums for me. the old plan would have cost us about $4,800. Offering a benefit like paid family leave keeps women like me in the workforce. I feel valued by my current company because we have a policy that says we know working moms have a lot to contribute to the workplace. Moms are flexible. Our plans change about 3 times a day. I was going to be here at 8:15 and I got to be here at 9 instead. Nice. Meant I got another hour of sleep. Thank you. We also know how to deal with challenging clients. Parents of any 3-year-old know that we have an increased patience and tolerance for irrational requests. House File 2113 would allow about 450,000 workers to be cut from this program. Excluding that many workers would cause costs to rise dramatically and destabilize the program. As an employee of a small business, I'm asking you to stop trying to kill this invaluable program by constantly seeking to exclude more workers. All Minnesotans and all Americans, I think, deserve paid family leave. Most Minnesotans are more than happy to pay a little so that we can all benefit. I urge you not to pass House File 2113. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Roski, for your testimony. Thanks for bringing in Little One, too. That's great. Next up is Ms. Fitzsimmons. Welcome. And then next up will be on Zoom, Justin Ziskut. So, Ms. Fitzsimmons, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Senior Policy Director with Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. And I'm here today to speak in strong opposition to House File 1213, which weakens a critical child well-being program, paid family and medical leave. In the first weeks after birth, infants are forming relationships that shape their development. Through everyday interactions, being held, fed, soothed, and responded to, babies build the neural pathways that support safety, trust, and early brain development. During this period, responsive, consistent caregiving is essential for healthy brain growth, physical development, and long-term well-being. This early parent-caregiver-infant bond and the healthy growth this relationship supports is exactly what is at stake in this bill. Under this bill, an estimated 450,000 Minnesotans, nearly 20% of the workforce, as you've already heard, would lose access to paid leave. Many of these Minnesotans are in the stage of life when they are starting families and raising young families, including having and caring for young children during this critical period of development. Studies show paid family leave is associated with reductions in infant mortality, and in some cases, up to a 50% decrease in infant rehospitalization in that first year of life. Paid leave also leads to higher rates of timely vaccinations and well child visits, ensuring babies get the early care they need. In addition to these physical health benefits, paid leave also plays a critical role in supporting maternal mental health during the postpartum period. We are already seeing how essential this support is to Minnesotans. More than 18,000 bonding applications for paid family and medical leave have already been approved in Minnesota, illustrating that many families are actively relying on this program during the earliest weeks and time of their children's lives. This should be good news. Exempting small businesses would weaken the core purpose of this program by tying access to employer size rather than family need, and as a result, a significant number of Minnesota families would be left without access during this critical period. From a child well-being and healthy development perspective, this bill does not advance Minnesota's goal of ensuring every infant has the strongest possible start in life. Please oppose this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzsimmons, very much for your testimony. Appreciate you being here. Justin, if you are online, I'll have you unmute yourself, and if you can join us. And then next up, I'm going to have Lars Nexgaard come up to the table, please. So, Justin, you're on if you can unmute yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 2113. My name is Justin Ziskut. I have been the owner of Sundance Auto Repair in Marshall, Minnesota for the past 10 years. I have 3 full-time employees, that's including myself, and 1 part-time employee as an intern. The PFML mandate that was put into effect in January is unworkable for my business. If either of my employees takes 20 weeks off, that puts their entire workload on me and my other employees. 20 weeks is a little over a third of the year. What if both of my employees take the leave at the same time? How would my business of this size last? It is already extremely difficult to find qualified technicians. I've been trying to hire another technician for 3 years with no luck. Hiring someone to cover my tech's workload while gone would prove to be almost an impossible task. What if my receptionist left for 20 weeks? I can't just hire someone to take that spot, train them in, and then send them on their way when my receptionist comes back. I only have one position in that role. No matter which way you look at it, the losses of even one employee severely impacts the ability of my business to operate at full capacity. The bottom line is small businesses have much more difficult time absorbing the loss of single employees. For employers with five employees, losing just one employee for 20 weeks results in a 20% hit to the capacity of that business. And the workload now needs to be covered by the four other people in that business. That is a huge impact. Then comes the fact that I have to pay the payroll tax on this program for myself. Why? I'll never be able to use it. The money that I am forced to give out, my own paycheck, will never get back to me. I save money for myself for things that arise in my life. I don't need the government to do it for me. This is the problem with government programs in the private business sector. They can't take all businesses into account and make them work for everyone. Individuals need to make plans for themselves, not the government doing it for them. In closing, I strongly urge you to support HF 2113 to provide a little bit more flexibility for small businesses like mine in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to come.
Thank you, Justin, for your testimony this morning. Lars Negstad is up next, and then if I could have Lauren Schotkorst come forward too, you would be on deck. Welcome, Lars.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for the opportunity to once again testify on paid family leave, my favorite topic to talk about. First of all, I want to give credit to Representative Robbins for the amendment, which does shrink the impact of this bill significantly. As originally written, the bill would have carved out over 1 million Minnesota workers, or about 40% of the workforce. This amendment language brings it down to only around 450,000 Minnesotans. However, her characterization of the amendment is not how the amendment reads. On the first page, lines 1.15, it reads small employer election of coverage. And I'm not a lawyer, but pretty clearly says that employers have the power to opt in or opt out of the program. So workers don't really have that choice. So really quick, four quick points. A person's access to paid leave should not depend on the goodwill of their employer. I'm sure all the good employers in the room, a lot of good employers in the state are doing everything they can to take care of their employees, but that's not always the case, and we shouldn't leave it up to only the employer. Second, paid leave is a social insurance program. This bill would significantly shrink the pool and potentially destabilize the program and increase costs for everyone. Third, the bill would add administrative complexity and confusion for workers, employers, and the paid leave administration. We haven't heard that talked about yet today, but I believe it would be very unworkable to implement. Fourth, this bill would create opportunities for employers to game the system by employing such tactics as misclassifying workers, reducing hiring, creating separate entities, and probably a bunch of other ways. So simply put, this bill would put a lot more power in the hands of employers to the detriment of employees, and you have a simple choice in front of you today. Thank you.
Thank you, Lars, for your testimony today. Appreciate that. Next up is Lauren Schotkorst. If you could introduce yourself, Lauren, please. Welcome back. And then Joel Hansen and Steve Gardner will be on deck. Thank you. Go ahead, Lauren.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lauren Schotkorst with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, a statewide business organization representing more than 6,300 businesses and over 500,000 employees throughout Minnesota. A majority of our members are small to mid-sized businesses. Making needed adjustments to the state's new paid family medical leave mandate is top of mind for the state's business community. Our members believe that you must address the operational challenges for both employers and employees to ensure that the program is balanced, functional, cost-controlled, and responsive to workplace dynamics. We support House File 2113, exempting super small employers from this onerous mandate while retaining their access to the program by enabling the opt-in. We also support the upcoming bill fixing the definition of seasonal employee under the law, and we'd further recommend the bipartisan and bicameral bill that Chair Baker and Senator Frentz have introduced, House File 2962, which encapsulates these and other modifications requested by the business community, including the previous testimony you heard about the individual employee's ability to opt in to the program. As you recently heard from the results of our paid family medical leave impact survey of nearly 700 business leaders, HR departments, and employees from across the state, the feedback was quite representative of the small Main Street business perspective, with 40% of respondents having fewer than 10 employees and 78% having fewer than 100 employees. Those respondents described the paid leave experience so far as negative, stating that this program was, in fact, not designed for small employers. Employers are also surprised by the negative employee reactions to this mandate, namely the payroll tax on their wages, and many workers themselves want to opt out. The core takeaway is that employers aren't hysterically debating the idea of paid leave. They're describing a costly mandate that was forced upon them that is an administrative nightmare and most disruptive for small and seasonal organizations. A one-size-fits-all mandate doesn't benefit everyone equally. It disproportionately negatively impacts our small businesses who have repeatedly asked for flexibility and choice. With this bill, Minnesota small businesses can choose to opt into this program if it suits their needs. Likewise, employees should also have the option to choose in to a wage replacement product should it suit their needs. This should have been the plan all along. We urge the committee to support House File 2113 and other bills that make reasonable modifications to this mandate before it gets too far out of alignment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Shothorse, for bringing that to us. Next up is Joel Hanson and Steve Gardner, the ABC. And then next on deck will be Andy Wilkie from the Greater Minnesota Greater Mankato Growth. So welcome. Joel, it looks like you're going to go first.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Baker, Chair Pinto, and members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House File 2113. My name is Joel Hanson. I'm a Director of Government and Public Affairs with Associated Builders and Contractors. We're a construction industry trade group with 350 members across the state of Minnesota that employ over 20,000 men and women in the construction industry. Just as a reminder to the committee, the construction industry is unique as it is, relates to paid family medical leave. Employees are able to negotiate through a collective bargaining agreement a waiver to paid family medical leave. However, that applies to only roughly 20% of the private construction industry. And so without further ado, I'll let you hear from a member of ours, Steve Gardner with Wilmer Electric, who represents 80% of the industry.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Welcome, Mr. Gardner. Please introduce yourself and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Gardner. I'm the Vice President of Operations for Wilmer Electric, a member of the Associated Builders and Contractors. The Associated Builders and Contractors has 146 firms that would be affected by this legislation, and makes up 42% of our businesses are small businesses. The construction industry operates on one simple principle: on time, under budget. Many of these firms are highly specialized and experience shortage of skilled workers, with some limited by supervisory rules set by this legislature, as Mr. Iyer pointed out earlier. And what she means by that is the journeyman to apprentice relationship. We operate primarily on fixed price contracts with no ability to pass along the cost of overtime or temp labor associated with the impact of losing members to paid family medical leave. We have no ability to pass that along to our customer unless we bid that into our price before we get the job. We're already operating on slim margins because we do operate in a competitive bid environment. Many of our contracts require us to sign on for liquidated damages. Liquidated damages adversely impact construction firms if we do not finish our projects on time or under budget. The paid family medical leave puts jobs at risk for apprentices. Our apprentices are new to the construction field and come at a time when we need people in the trades. If we lose a journeyman to paid family medical leave, we run the risk of laying our apprentices off because those apprentices must be supervised by a licensed journeyman. We cannot simply bring in a temp person to supervise them. Paid family medical leave, well, I believe, is well-intentioned and designed to take care of people. We believe the best way to take care of people is having a firm to them for them to come back to once they come off of paid family medical leave. They cannot come back to a firm that is out of business because we simply cannot operate without employees. Thank you for considering House File 2113.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner and Mr. Carlson. Appreciate you coming in. Mr. Wilkie, thank you to joining us today from Greater Mankato Growth. Please introduce yourself. Mary Schaffler will be on Zoom with us, and she'll be on deck. So, Mr. Wilkie, welcome.
Thank you, Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Andy Wilkie. I serve as the Executive Vice President of Greater Mankato Growth, the Chamber of Commerce and Economic Development Organization in the Greater Mankato region. I'm here to express our support for House File 2113. Greater Mankato Growth represents hundreds of employers across south central Minnesota, many of them small businesses with fewer than 15 employees. These employers care deeply about their workers and want to do right by them. One small business owner recently told me, "We support paid leave, but when one person is out, there often isn't anyone to step in. And today's labor market, we simply can't find temporary help to fill the gap. The challenge is real. When a small business loses one employee for an extended period, it can mean longer hours for coworkers, delayed orders, and turning away work altogether. Not because the employer doesn't value their employees, but because they don't have the scale or staffing flexibility to absorb this disruption. We fully recognize and share the legislature's goal of ensuring workers can care for themselves and their families without risking their livelihoods. At the same time, it's important to acknowledge that policies designed for large employers can have very different impacts on small businesses, especially in greater Minnesota. House File 2113 offers a balanced and thoughtful solution by exempting employers with 15 or fewer employees while still allowing them to opt in voluntarily. The bill preserves worker protections while reducing the risk of unintended harm to small employers and their employees. For those reasons, Greater Mankato Growth respectfully encourages the support of 2113. Thank you for your time and consideration.
And thank you, Mr. Wilkie, for your time. Mary Schaffler is on Zoom, and then also on deck will be Wendy Anderson, also joining us by Zoom. Ms. Schaffler, if you could unmute yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony to support the House File 2113. My name is Mary Schaffler, and I'm one of the owners of Salient Incorporated. Salient Incorporated is a young, small, niche S corporation, only in business for 7 years. We manufacture specialty cutting tools for primarily the medical industry, but aerospace, firearms, and many other businesses. Our tools are not tools you can purchase in a catalog. They are all custom-built, custom-designed cutting tools. We have 6 full-time employees, 2 office workers. Both of us are the S-Corp owners. We are paying into the PFML benefit, but we will most likely never be able to use it. We hired a new college graduate who is training to become a CNC grinding operator, and we have 3 very good CNC grinding operators. The operator position is a highly skilled position that is not taught in any schools. This is a position learned on the job. It's a position that takes at least 1 full year to train a person to do the basics of the tool grinding skills. If any of our employees were on leave of absence for a length of time, we would not be able to meet our customer deadlines. With only 3 CNC grinding operators and 1 being trained, it would leave us with no choice but to shut down the company because it would not be affordable to stay in business and we could never meet the customer deadlines. We are already operating as lean as we possibly can. The uncertainty PFML is causing my small company is that if 1 employee, a seasoned grinder, 1/3 of our production operators, were to take 12 to 20 weeks leave, our remaining 2 operators could not make up the 40 hours of lost time each week. This would be a big burden. We would not be able to fill the position on such short notice. And it's unreasonable and unhealthy to expect other people to work 60 to 80 hours a week.
Ms. Schaffler, I need to wrap up. Thank you.
One moment, please. Not to mention the cost of paying overtime. Our employees are paid very well. Overtime typically adds up to $50 or more an hour, and it adds up quickly. To have the opportunity to opt out of PFML would allow us to remain competitive and stay in business in Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Schaffler.
Businesses like mine to remain in business and not be forced to submit payments to a benefit that could potentially hurt or even eliminate our small company.
Thank you, Michelle Fleur. Thank you so much. I appreciate your testimony today. Wendy Anderson, if you could please unmute yourself and join us, and then Megan Horsager would be on deck next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me the opportunity to provide testimony in support of House File 2113. My name is Wendy Anderson. We are a pump and blower distributor with a dedicated repair department. We've been in business for over 70 years, serving industrial and municipal customers, and we have 15 team members. I'm here to express my concerns about PFML program and the real impact on small businesses now that is in effect. The compliance requirements tied to this program are overwhelming for small businesses. The reporting, tracking, and monitoring expectations at a level of administrative complexity that we're not equipped to handle. Unlike large employers, small businesses do not have dedicated HR teams, payroll departments, or benefits administrators. In many cases, like ours, one person's responsible for accounts receivable, accounts payable, payroll, HR, benefits, operations, just to name a few. Adding PFML compliance to that workload is not sustainable for us. It took us over 6 months of ongoing coordination with our payroll provider to get the tax deductions properly implemented, time that is not simply available when I'm personally already working over 10 hours a day, 6 to 7 days a week, managing all aspects of our business. The financial impact of the cost of the program goes far beyond the required contributions. We are already seeing increased expenses related to compliance, administration, and the legal guidance. When ESST went into effect, we spent thousands of dollars in legal fees just trying to understand and document that program to be in compliance. And with PFML, we expect those costs to be even higher. We've actually been referred to our lawyer by the state of Minnesota in regard to understanding the program. So those costs add to small businesses. We also know that similar programs in other states have required billions in funding. That raises serious concerns about long-term sustainability and the likelihood of increasing cost over time for this program. The operational impact is immediate and real. We recently hired a new employee to replace a retiring team member and quickly learned that that new hire already plans to take the leave. It takes 1 to 2 years for us to train employees, so it's just time that we don't have.
Ms. Anderson, if you could wrap it up, that'd be great.
Okay. So I guess the biggest thing is for us is we have no safety net. We cannot easily redistribute the work or bring in temporary replacements without significant cost and disruption to our business.
All right. Thank you. I got to go. Thank you so much for that, Ms. Anderson. Appreciate your time. Again, this is tough to kind of manage the clock today, but I appreciate that very much. Ms. Horsager, if you are also online, I appreciate that. And again, reminding 2 minutes is what we're looking at. So go ahead.
Hi, I'm Megan, and I farm in western Minnesota. Our farm is a small family farm, and we have found the best way to structure our farm. My dad and I are owners, and then my mother is an employee. And prior to paid family leave, my mother was allowed to take off whatever day she wanted for any reason. And so in addition to the very unnecessary financial burden, this has caused our operation. I'm going to echo what Wendy said of the administration. On our farm, I am the HR department, and I am not an HR expert. I have already put in a very disproportional amount of time in trying to understand this program, and I still feel like I am questionably in compliance. I am not an expert at this, and it's been a huge burden. I've looked at outsourcing to an HR firm, but that is a huge financial burden, and as a very cash-poor beginning farmer, that's just not something that's realistic on our operation. And in addition to that, my mother is not a typical W-2 employee. We pay her with commodity wages, and no one's even been able to tell me how I'm supposed to implement this program in that situation. And so it's been a lot of frustration for a program we're never going to use. And so I really support this bill and an exemption for small business. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Horsager. Appreciate your testimony. And finally on the list is Jake Vlamic, also on Zoom. Jake, if you could go ahead, introduce yourself, and continue. Jake, do you want to unmute yourself?
Sorry, little technology challenges. So my name is Jake Vlamic. I want to thanks for the opportunity to speak today in support of this House bill, House File 2113. My family and I, we run a small turkey farm just south of Wilmer. My father-in-law and my brother-in-law and myself, we operate, own and operate the business and are the majority share. We're the shareholders. So including the three of us, we have a total of 10 people on our payroll. Half are full-time, the other half are retired people who want to keep busy, or other people who just want to help out while they work their other full-time jobs. We all work closely with one another. We communicate, and we provide great benefits for our employees, including health care, which is fully covered by the company at cost. Company matches to retirement funds, health care savings, and we also have a generous paid time off program. So my biggest concern with this program for our small company is that it's going to place a faceless government entity in between me and my employees when we can work together on issues that we don't need a government entity to try and tell us how it's going to work. I don't see any benefit to this program. In fact, it's actually have placed four more liability accounts on my payroll that I have to keep track of now. And being a small farmer, I spend as little time in the office as possible. I like to be out working the farm, working with the turkeys, and working with the employees one-on-one. So this has forced me to not only engage with an HR firm to help manage this process, it's also more paperwork for my CPA, which is, again, more fees that we have to then pay. Another cost of business, I guess, in Minnesota, it's forcing us to participate in a program that we will never be able to benefit from. I understand other people want our funds to be in there because they're afraid the program will collapse without our participation. But I'm buying insurance for a program I will never be able to participate in. And so if that were the case in the private industry, I would just cancel that policy if it's not something I need. So I thank you for your time. And I ask you support House File 2113.
Thank you, Mr. Vlamic. I appreciate your testimony today. That ends our testimony to member questions. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a question for the author just about how this bill will work, because I see that, you know, when we talk about businesses with under 15 employees, we're talking about 450,000 Minnesotans, so 20% of the workforce. And if in one of those if I work for a business under 15 that has not opted into the program under your bill, would I be able to get paid family medical leave if I wanted it?
Chair Robbins.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. So my understanding of the amendment is that the employer does have to opt in to participate, and then employees can opt in. And so it says, upon the approval of the commissioner, so the an employer with 15 or fewer employees may file in a format prescribed, blah, blah, they may, their employees of that employer are then entitled to enter benefits. So the employer under the amendment opts in. So I would be very happy to have a separate amendment to say employees individually, regardless of their employer choosing to opt in, that the employees themselves can opt in. Because I think both are absolutely important. Because some people do want it and need it. But my understanding, honestly, is that that is not true in how Colorado does it, is that employees may opt in, to the point you're saying employers don't have to for employees to be able to opt in. And in Maine, employees, they also exempt small businesses, but they allow employees to opt in. So there's a model out there, and if that's the preferred model versus saying the employer opts in, I'm totally fine with that. So that's how Colorado and Maine currently do it, and I would be happy to entertain an amendment on that, or if you lay it over to work on that. But the point, I think, is that we need the flexibility. So I think the testifiers have spoken to that very well. Most of the other states that have paid family leave have recognized the complexity and hardship on these very small businesses, and they provided this exemption. And we would be just in line with what other states have been doing. But to your point, if we want to create an employee opt-in, I'm perfectly fine with that.
Thank you, Chair. And I think I misspoke earlier to Representative Greenman too, that the employees could opt in. I think it was not specific to that. That's my call. That's my mistake. Thank you for clarifying that. And you're right. We would be happy to that amendment. Back to you.
And I know we're tight on time, so I will just turn my next question into a comment, because that the way that it's currently drafting is if an employer doesn't opt in, not only would the employee, if they would want PFML, can't opt in, they would be in a worse position than an independent contractor who, under the bill we passed, can opt in. And the thing that matters to me is we've been talking about this. We have seen in this committee bill after bill creating carve-outs about PFML. And the fact that nobody thought about the employees who would want to opt in, that was not factored in here, is a huge concern. And so when I think about what this bill is, you know, we should put workers at the center of our policymaking, which means if any worker or workers' rights organization would have, and I think that's what we heard, would have looked at this, that's what they have said. So to me, one, this bill isn't ready for prime time, but two, after 2 years of sitting in this committee, seeing folks try to carve out workers, it is clear to me what this is about is trying to give power and decision-making exclusively to employers, and not all the small businesses that we heard wanted this, but to a set of employers. We've seen the chamber over and over and over again in this committee. And so what I would like, I wish that in this committee we focused workers, and the workers, the 450,000 Minnesotans, who will lose access to this benefit if this bill passes. So, Mr. Chair, this is a no for me.
Thank you. Representative Mueller. So members, I'm going to try to wrap this up in about another 10 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Baker. And thank you, Chair Robbins, for bringing the bill. I just so happened, without anyone really knowing that this bill was coming up, I just so happened to receive an email from one of my business owners, from one of my job creators. And one of the things that the reason why we talk about job creators so much is because without those jobs, without that person having that business, there are no jobs then. And so that's why it's really important. We want to value both, because we understand the value of both, and we have to understand that they are creating jobs. And I just wanted to read this part, and the business owner didn't give me permission to state his name, and so I wanted to just said, you know, I am very, he says that we've had a job opening since the beginning of January, but nothing. The powers be at state say everyone should be happier with ESST and paid family medical leave. Well, I'm not. We are in rural Minnesota, and I can't keep raising prices. I will price out 50% of our clients or more. I won't take out any more loans. Why would I continue to throw money away? I should be happy, but I have to limit my services because we only have 5 staff plus me. I don't have time to do everything. And then he says, I'm done. The Democrat trifecta and walls has won. They have beaten me. I truly don't care anymore, and that makes me hurt even more. And so there are plenty of other people like my friend here who are asking for what you are providing in this bill. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I'm a yes.
Thank you. Representative Pete Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Robbins, for bringing this discussion. I'll be brief and just make it a comment. We heard a lot from testifiers about what happens when somebody uses paid leave. It's devastating for it could be potentially devastating for their business to lose somebody for up to 20 weeks. I want to refocus a little bit on that, on what that means for the employee. Like, if you are qualified for a medical leave, you had a serious medical issue, or somebody you care deeply about had a serious medical issue. Or you had a birth of a child and you want a amount of time to bond with that child. I mean, we talk about a bunch of other pieces with that. So I just want to refocus on the people that are impacted by that part as well and remind people, and it, like we talked about this last session, but remind people that people have been getting injured, they've been getting sick, they've lost loved ones, they've been having kids long before paid family medical leave went into effect. So if those businesses were fortunate enough that none of those things ever happened to their employees, that's great. But there's a lot of people that had to make really hard choices or lost jobs or weren't able to spend time with their loved ones or weren't able to heal and recover properly, weren't able to spend time with new babies prior to this law, and this gives them a little bit of a window to do that. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wayne Johnson, final member.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Robbins, for bringing this flexibility bill forward. As a small business, you know that flexibility is everything. That's what you start off, and that's the only way you can succeed, and that's what this bill does. We also recognize that most businesses start as small businesses with the goal of becoming a big business. And as you grow your business, you can start providing more benefits. We all know Best Buy provides more benefits than somebody that just working that's two people and stuff like that. So the goal is there. One of the things that continues to amaze me here is the desire and the mandates that are put on businesses that make people decide not to start businesses. And we are seeing those effects by a recent report that came out that Minnesota now is towards the bottom in percentage of new businesses starting. Near the bottom, like six from the bottom now. So that means businesses or people looking to buy a business have now realized there's too many mandates, too many costs, too many headaches to start. And so I'd just like to say to those who believe and continue to want to put mandates on business to stop businesses from even starting or succeeding, congratulations. It's working out for you. Thank you.
Representative Mecklen, did you have a quick comment?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair Baker. I believe it's Mr. Gardner who mentioned, touched on this. So I understand that the position that some of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle don't have the same thought process we do about the hardships for the employers. But there is one sector that is currently being affected by this, and that is these apprentice electricians. Because no part of them asked for this to suddenly be put on unemployment because somebody wanted to exercise the benefit of paid family medical leave. And we've been trying to figure this out, but these are that just literally two people who get stuck on unemployment for up to 12 weeks, or potentially even longer. And their whole goal is to get their 8,000 hours in to get to that journeyman test, which if this happened to them every year for 12 weeks, it would be a five-year plan instead of a four. This has to be addressed, and with that, Chair Baker, I ask for a roll call.
Thank you. Roll call has been requested. See no mother
Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. Yeah.
I thought you took it off.
I was telling you I didn't have to be right away.
Chair Panto, go ahead.
Thank you, sir. So a couple things. So Representative Mecklen, you used the phrase people who want to exercise the benefit. I think that if somebody has a new baby, they want to exercise the benefit. They want to be with that new baby. We heard powerful testimony about the child development benefits and bonding, which just makes sense when a parent is with a young child. Otherwise, you don't want to exercise the benefit because it means that you're seriously ill or somebody you care about is seriously ill and you needed to care for them. So I think it's we sort of have to reframe and rethink this. I had heard repeatedly comments made about multiple states exempting small businesses. I don't think that's correct, and I wonder if we have Commissioner Rowe come up, and I can ask the question as he comes up, Mr. Chair, to save time.
Yeah, very briefly, if you can come up quickly.
I know we want to keep moving. And just if you could briefly say, Commissioner Rowe, like, what is the situation? Representative Robbins laid out a number of states that she said exempt small businesses. That's not consistent with my understanding. So can you just say sort of what other states exempt small businesses in this way?
Mr. Rowe, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Pinto, to our knowledge, the only state that has some sort of carve-out for small employers is Delaware, which allows that for up to, I think, employers up to 10 employees. I've got Colorado's website pulled up. I heard that one was noted, and just quoting from that, small employers are not, with fewer than 10 employees, are not required to pay the employer contribution to the program. However, they still need to withhold the employee contribution, and their staff are, and their employees are eligible for the program. So I think there are some states that exempt small employers from paying premiums under that. Minnesota has a small employer premium rate that is a reduced premium rate. But to our knowledge, Colorado covers all workers. Maine covers all workers. Rhode Island covers all workers. There may be differences in premium rates for small employers, as there is here in Minnesota.
Well, and to that, I just want to comment too. Yeah. There's been the other 12 states that I've certainly examined as well. A lot of them have different carve outs for different things. It could be small business. It could be the employer, like Mr. Rowe said, the employer is not paying the payroll tax. The employee would pay 100% of it. There's some that have exempted school employees, and so there's a lot of different versions of it out there. But there are carve outs in other states.
Yeah.
I want to make that clear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Pinnell. I guess the fact is, though, that despite the assertions, there's only one state. I don't know what's going on with Delaware, but all the other states that have this, in fact, if you work at a small business, you're included. And maybe so, Representative Robbins, and thank you, Commissioner. I don't think I'll need you again. Representative Robbins, I don't think you'd be saying, but please clarify this, that somebody who works at a small business is less likely to need that powerful bonding time with their child grows up more quickly or something, or that they are less likely to get sick. I assume that's not the drive behind this. So can you just, why would somebody at those small businesses need that benefit less, or is there something else behind that?
Chair Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, if you might allow me to just comment on the other piece of it. So my understanding, and my research could be wrong, so I appreciate Commissioner being here and you raising this, but my understanding is that in Delaware, they are fully exempt for small businesses. And there's some allowance for people with 10 to 24 employees being allowed to take parental leave only, but it's nuanced, and that the exemption applies to 25 and under. In Oregon, well, I could go through this, but I just want you to know I did do research, and the sources I found said it differently. So
okay.
We can maybe have staff look at that later on.
Sure.
And then to your larger point, of course, Mr. Chair, everyone who wants the leave should be able to access it with the right provisions for meeting the needs of the business as well. The employer-employee sort of social contract has existed for millennia. And they have always found ways to work it out. And my dad owned a funeral home, a small business, and I saw firsthand how, and we've heard stories from other small businesses, they bend over backwards to help their employees. And they find very creative solutions to keep people on the job, to help them when they have needs in their family life or in their personal life. And I saw that firsthand, and I think that's how most of the small businesses operate. And to the extent that my dad, honestly, would create jobs for people, part-time jobs, when sort of we were from a mining community. The mines closed down. All of a sudden, my dad had three new part-time employees because he was trying to help people keep their families alive. We had an employee who passed away suddenly from a heart attack. His widow had a young child. He created a opportunity for her to answer the funeral home phones, even though we probably didn't really need that help. You know, so there are examples all over the place of how small businesses try to help their employees. But I would remind this body that when this bill first was considered in 2023, we had an alternative that was fully allowing employees to opt in to a paid family leave program, like an insurance product similar to disability. And that would have allowed employees to have the option to participate in something like that. But it wouldn't have created a 400-person new bureaucracy, a deed. It wouldn't have been a one-size-fits-all mandate. And it wouldn't have cost the state of Minnesota all this money. And it preserved flexibility. Not all employees want this. If you're in a certain stage of life, you may not think you need parental leave. But So the bill we had back in 2023 would have allowed employees to be the driver and would have provided flexibility without a one-size-fits-all mandate. And I would also submit, members, that our program in the generous benefits set for both the personal paid leave and for the caregiving side far exceeds what some of these other states have, where they do give the exemption for small business. So I think we need to look at the level of the benefits we have mandated and maybe think about how we're managing that, as well as giving flexibility to employees to opt in. So I think we can find a solution, members, that works for everyone. And maybe my bill isn't it, but we need to give more flexibility for small businesses, for seasonal and part-time employees. This is so onerous, and it is hurting people's ability to keep their businesses afloat.
And thank you for that. I'm going to wrap it up, Mr. Chair. So I'm going to closing comments. Chair Robbins, please.
I think that can suffice, members. I appreciate the opportunity. I think it's been a very good conversation, and I'm happy to look at an amendment that would allow employees to opt in. I really think preserving flexibility for our smallest employers, like other states have recognized as important, is the path forward. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much. The chair requests a roll call on this vote, too. We're going to go ahead and take a vote on House File 2113 as presented, as amended, to be carried to the Committee on Ways and Means. Clerk will take the roll. Chair votes aye.
Chair Pinto.
No.
Vice Chair Meckland.
Aye.
Vice Chair Greenman.
No.
Representative Bakeberg.
Yes.
Representative Berg.
No.
Representative Frazier. Representative Hussein.
No.
Representative Johnson Pete.
No.
Representative Johnson Wayne.
Aye.
Representative Kozlowski.
Gawain, no.
Representative Mueller.
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Schultz.
Yes.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Zalesnikar, aye.
Seeing seven ayes and six nays, the bill does not move forward. It'll be laid over for further consideration. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, to bring this bill forward. We have two more bills up. We're going to try to move it quickly. If Rep. Bakeberg could move forward with our next bill, House File 4569. And again, we're going to move this really quickly, if we could, please, just because of time. Rep. Bakeberg moves House File 4569, and that'll be referred to Ways and Means. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Pinto, and members. My name is Ben Bakeberg. I have the privilege to represent the communities of Prior Lake, Jordan, and Shakopee. One of the main topics that I hear as I'm out and about in the community are questions around paid family medical leave. I think we all can agree, and we've had a robust conversation today, that we want people to be with family members who are struggling with medical issues or having a baby. Today is actually my daughter's 22nd birthday, so happy birthday to her. But we have to balance the realities of what's happening to our businesses and our workers across the state. So House File 4569 is a bill to update the paid family medical leave by broadening the definition of seasonal employee. Currently under law, the seasonal employee is someone in the hospitality industry who works no more than 150 days in a consecutive 52-week period. So what this bill would do would expand the threshold from 150 to 180 days worked, and then apply the definition of the definition to all industries, not just hospitality. The goal of this bill is to ensure that paid family medical leave is workable, predictable, and sustainable for our businesses and our employees. This matters because many of the industries operate on a seasonal basis outside of the hospitality industries, such as construction, agriculture, recreation, landscaping, tourism. The current 150-day limit is often too restrictive and doesn't take into account the real-world realities of our businesses. expanding to 180 days better aligns to how seasonal work actually works in Minnesota's economy. I recently had a conversation with an employee, and he said to me, said, you know, Ben, the best, most pro worker policy is for me to have a job. So that's what the intent of this bill is to make paid leave sustainable and workable so employers can continue to create jobs and employees have a job. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would move to testimony.
Thank you. I'll have Ms. Hengmuley come forward, please, if I got that right. I'm so sorry. And then also Melissa Heising, if they would come forward. We're going to be really quick. I'm going to actually cut it down to about a minute and a half, so we're going to even make it tighter. So I appreciate you being here. Renee, if you could go first. And my apologies on your last name if I messed that up.
That's okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Renee Hengemill, and I'm the Human Resources Director of Valley Fair. Valley Fair is a Minnesota's only major amusement park in the and the largest in the upper Midwest. We've been part of the Minnesota community for nearly 50 years. Our 50th anniversary season opens this May. We are proud of the role we have played in driving regional tourism and economic activity in Shakopee, Scott County, and the broader Twin Cities metro. Like all amusement parks, our business is inherently seasonal. We operate from approximately May to late October. To deliver a safe, high-quality guest experience during during that window, we hire more than 1,600 seasonal employees each year. These seasonal employees are largely students, teachers on spring break, retirees, and returning employees who depend on us to keep on a key part of their annual income. We are one of the largest seasonal employers in the South Metro. When the legislature created the seasonal employee exemption for the PFML program, the intent was clear. Workers in truly seasonal positions at genuinely seasonal employee businesses should not be burdened by a program designed for a year-round employment relationship. We are with that intent. The problem with the current exception is too narrow to achieve it. The law limits the seasonal designation to the employees who primarily work in a hospitality definition under the Minnesota Statute 157.15, a definition built around restaurants, hotels, and food service establishments.
Yep. Thank you. Okay, I need to wrap it up. Anything final? Sorry.
Nope, that's okay.
All right, thank you so much. Yep. Appreciate that. Melissa Heising, if you could please forward. Go ahead. And then next on deck is Ryan Hamilton. If you could come forward. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Melissa Heising, and I'm the Legislative Director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO. We are the State Labor Federation representing most public sector, private sector, and building trades unions across the state. And I'm here to testify in opposition to House File 4569, as well as the previous bill and the upcoming bill. Minnesota AFL-CIO is proud to have advocated for paid family and medical leave for nearly a decade as part of a broad coalition. Before passage of the new law in 2023, the vast majority of working Minnesotans did not have access to paid family and medical leave benefits. Thanks to the new paid leave program, working Minnesotans from all walks of life are finally able to take paid leave to care for themselves and their loved ones and to bond with their children. Minnesota's unions advocated for this law to create a minimum standard for paid leave for all workers, both union and non-union. Minimum labor standards create a floor so that no worker is left behind. House File 4569, as well as House File 2113 and 4414, would cut holes in that floor, causing workers to fall through and undermining the structural integrity of the program. Some critics of the program characterize it as one size fits all, but that is far from accurate. In the paid leave program, each worker's wage replacement rate is determined by their wage credits in the system, and the length of leave depends on what the worker needs. But if we want to use the T-shirt analogy of one size fits all, under these bills, large numbers of workers would end up with a shirt that is too small, too expensive, or no shirt at all. Deed has done a phenomenal job building and rolling out this program. Let's not jeopardize what has been a smooth rollout so far by requiring them to administer complex carve-outs that would take this earned benefit away from many workers. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your comments. Mr. Hamilton, welcome. And then up next is Lars Nesgard. Go ahead, Mr. Hamilton.
Good morning, Chair Baker and Chair Pinto and members. My name is Ryan Hamilton. I serve as Director of Government Relations for Hospitality Minnesota, representing restaurants, hotels, resorts, caterers, and entertainment venues across the state. Hospitality Minnesota supports House File 4569. The bill makes a sensible correction to Minnesota's paid leave law by changing the seasonal employee definition from 150 days to 180 days, matching the 6 months receipts test that's already built into the statute. Under current law, a seasonal employee is capped at 150 days, even though the employer-side receipts test already measures seasonality across 6 months. So House File 4569 fixes that mismatch. For seasonal hospitality operators, especially in greater Minnesota and tourism-driven communities, that 30-day gap matters in the real world. It creates an unnecessary staffing problems at the margins of a season when businesses still need workers, workers still want hours, and communities still rely on those establishments being open and operating. House File 4569 offers a practical, clarifying change that better reflects how seasonal businesses actually function. We respectfully ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton, very much. Mr. Nesgard, welcome back to the table. And then Mr. Danielson is on deck for the final.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am still Lars Neistat, and I'm still the policy director for ISAIA. Minnesota's paid leave law was thoughtfully crafted over the past 12 years, and I'd like to make just four quick points. First, the program was created with equity in mind to reach workers who have been historically denied access in the past to benefit from social programs. Expanding the carve-out beyond hospitality would exacerbate disparities based on race, ethnicity, and gender. Second, the program includes a relatively high earnings threshold to qualify for benefits compared to several other states. In Minnesota, the earnings threshold stands at $3,900 currently and will increase annually with a statewide average wage. California, Connecticut, Colorado, and Oregon all have much lower earnings thresholds ranging from $300 to $2,500. Third, the job protections in Minnesota's paid leave statute do not kick in for 90 days, a concession that was made to employer groups in 2018. And finally, expanding seasonal carve-out beyond the hospitality industry would add administrative complexity and confusion for workers, employers, and the administration, requiring even more individual evaluations of employers to determine whether they meet this specific unique test. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Nesgard. And then finally, Mr. Danielson, welcome, and go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Baker and members. My name is Dalton Danielson, Fiscal Policy Director with the Minnesota Business Partnership. The Minnesota Business Partnership is an association of CEOs and senior execs from Minnesota's most innovative and respected large companies. I'm here today in strong support of House File 4569, which makes a narrow, reasonable, and targeted update to Minnesota's paid family medical leave law by modernizing the definition of a seasonal employee. One reality we ask you consider is that many jobs exist for defined portions of the year tied to weather, tourism, agriculture, retail cycles, and construction seasons. These roles are essential to our economy, but they are, by nature, temporary. House File 4569 responds to this reality in a measured way by extending the seasonal employment threshold from 150 to 180 days and recognizing that seasonal work exists across industries, not just hospitality. Finally, I'll conclude by saying this bill makes Minnesota's paid family medical leave law more precise, more workable, and more durable over time. For those reasons, we ask you support House File 4569. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And we have one member question, Kozlowski, and then I'm going to turn over to following closing comments. Another one for Mr. Pinto. Okay, yeah, got it. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Baker.
Very brief.
Thank you, Chair Baker and Representative Baker. How many workers are currently exempted from PFML as seasonal employees?
Rep. Baker.
So in my conversations with stakeholders, this would impact roughly about 10 to 20% of the workers that would fall under the seasonal category. It's hard to get an exact number just with what I've gotten from the employers that I've been talking to.
Rep. Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Baker and Representative Bakeberg. I know we're running out of time here. We're talking about 10 to 20% estimates on top of trying to strike out 18% of Minnesota workers. I'll say I won't ask you. I know the answer with the work that we've done on minimum wage and how many of our seasonal workers are making the least at minimum wage, how hard we had to fight already to get our youth in there, our J-1 visa holders who, by the way, don't just work for that short amount of time. They're here for months and years and are the backbone of our hospitality industry, especially up on the North Shore for our tribal nations. I'm incredibly concerned, as has been brought up in testimony, just the hatchet that we continue to take, particularly for women, people of color, immigrants, workers who are working two and three jobs just to make it by. I'll be a broken record because we have workers who are working two and three jobs making the least, and as we heard that the $3,900 threshold, I'll tell you that I just sat with a constituent in my community last week who is making minimum wage, who had a stroke, and the first thing that they said was, I need to get to work so that I can pay my mortgage. Mortgages that are going into foreclosure. In Minnesota, we've seen a 50% increase, according to the Home Ownership Center. There was a report that retirement funds are being drawn due to hardship. That buffer is becoming a safety net. The top two reasons is for rent and for medical debt. And so this is a lifeline, and this is cannot continue to be borne off the backs of the workers who are making the least. Continue to take a hatchet.
Thank you, Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Baker, I feel like the testimony was so focused on hospitality. Why expand beyond that in the bill?
Yeah.
Go on, Rep. Bakeberg.
The simple truth is seasonality is not just unique to hospitality. We could have a long conversation about that, but what I talked about is, you know, in our packet we have a letter from the ski resort associations, which many of us represent, and they talked about the importance of expanding seasonality beyond hospitality. So I think the seasonality nature of the work in Minnesota, it plays into the construction industry, into agriculture, into outdoor recreation, into in Shakopee we have Valley Fair who testified. We also have Mystic Lake Amphitheater that is about to open up, which we're very excited about. So seasonality of work is not just defined to the hospitality industry.
And I'll maybe we're just gonna final comment.
Well, yeah, just I guess Representative Bakeberg, that confused me a little bit because I feel like a lot of the organizations you identified would be within hospitality. But in any case, so clearly a lot more conversations to be had. We won't be supporting this at this time. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So we'll move on to final comments. We're going to take the vote and we're going to move on. So we're going to do that.
Yep.
We got to close this up. We're running out of time, so this will be our final bill of the day. Final comments?
Yep, the most pro-worker policy is for them to have a job to go to. That's the intent of this bill, and that's what we want to maintain. Thank you.
And Chair Baker, I'd like to request a roll call.
All right, roll call being had. House File 4569 will be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Roll call has been requested. Chair votes aye.
Chair Pinto.
No.
Vice Chair Mekeland.
Yes.
Vice Chair Greenman.
No.
Representative Bakeberg.
Yes.
Representative Berg.
No.
Representative Hussein.
No.
Representative Johnson Pete.
No.
Representative Johnson Wayne.
Aye.
Representative Kozlowski.
No.
Representative Mueller.
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Schultz.
Yes.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Yes.
Thank you, members. That motion does not prevail. The bill will be laid over for further consideration. And again, just we have one more bill going, but we're going to have to not do that today, so that'll be fine. We're going to have to readdress that maybe at another time. Members, that concludes our agenda for today. We are adjourned.